Welcome to this delayed episode of Cider Voice. We actually recorded this conversation here with the wonderful Leo and Emma from Blue Barrel Cider in Nottingham last August, and I apologise that it has taken this long to get it out to you. I hope you enjoy listening to them. A really interesting, unique cidery with a lot of passion behind it. I will warn you that the ending comes quite abruptly, and to be honest, I don't remember now why that is. We're definitely at the end of the conversation, but I apologise that it just sort of ends right as Leo is musing on the challenge of being a 7,000 litre producer. But anyway, I hope you enjoy it, and I highly recommend and encourage that you seek out Blue Barrel Cider and try some for yourself. Welcome to the Cider Voice Calls podcast. Please, can you introduce yourselves, tell us what your cidery is called, and where you came from?
Okay, my name's Leo Jordan. And this is...
I'm Emma.
And we run Blue Barrel Cider. We're a cider company based in Nottingham. And it's a project of Somerwood Community Garden. So the cider is what funds partly the community garden. Emma, do you want to talk about that a bit? You're probably pretty good at giving a rounded picture of the whole project.
Okay, so we set up the community garden in 2008 with local community groups and local residents, and it's based on an estate in inner Nottingham, and we just happened to stumble across looking for activities to do with people who came to the garden, and we stumbled across apple presses and doing that in October as something to do once the growing season has stopped. And we had an apple day, and we pressed, as you can imagine, surplus fruit that people brought, far too much juice that we knew what to do with, and accidentally started making cider. And then we got married, actually, and we came on a honeymoon to Ross and Wye, stumbled across it on a little road trip, and got invited into the cellar by Mike, and we're really inspired. It was a big moment for us, actually. We got really inspired about making it on the scale, well, not on the scale, but on the in the quality, and the way that they were doing it on Ross was just exactly what we wanted to do. And so we started exploring doing more cider on a more professional scale. We actually got some funding and some support from the Federation of City Farms Community Gardens to go and do an apple course at Pershaw. So we learnt about sort of the more professional side of making apple juice and kind of all the sort of ways of setting up a cidery and sort of making juice. And from there, we registered it as a cider business. And now it funds about 40% of the community garden project. So it's been a big asset, really good way of helping us keep going throughout the years.
Yeah, and then so for people who don't know what a community garden entails, you're growing all sorts of vegetables and stuff.
Yeah, so the community garden works with local groups and local residents, and the main ethos is growing local food and showing people how to grow local food. But it's also quite a kind of broad things that what we do as well is supporting people with mental health issues. It's working with local families and supporting them and delivering things like free holiday activities for the community, so for people to access. And during those activities, they'll learn about food growing. We'll do seed planting. We also have like an outdoor kitchen area, so we incorporate showing them how to harvest food and cook healthy food and then cook it outside. We've got a wood-fired oven, and we do beekeeping. So it's kind of like showing people about sustainability and environmental things as well.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely fantastic. So going back to cider, you say you're inspired by Ross and Wye. What's the sort of philosophy that governs your process for cider making?
I guess philosophy-wise, it's always been about the environment. From the beginning, I think, even before the community garden, I loved the whole growing. You know, I was born in a little village, so I was born a green finger, so I was always pretty good at growing things, and it started off with bonsais and then maybe grafting. I always liked grafting fruit trees, you know, the growing, the nurturing them in a little nursery. You graft about 100 apple trees a year and distribute them to different places around the estate and around Nottinghamshire. We work with Trees for Cities, one of the projects actually, which is planting public spaces with the city council. So I've always loved the environmental side of it. And actually the selling of cider kind of funds us to do this sort of environmental campaign, I suppose, or way of life even, you could say. And so, yeah, I guess so the philosophy is all about producing cider, which then benefits the world and the environment the best we can. And yeah,
and that's how we started as well, was we started using surplus fruit. And so we were using a lot of surplus fruit that, especially in Clifton, they seem to have planted quite a lot of, it's like an estate on the south side of Nottingham, and they've planted loads of ornamental apple trees, and they do crop really heavily, and it turns out they make fairly good cider, or we think very good cider. We've won awards with the cider that we've made using just these trees along this particular avenue in one of the streets, and they were just rotting every year, and then we were watching them rotting every year and driving past them on the way back.
I think there were 13 of them, and they've all got bright red blossom. You cut the branch and even the sap's red, and it's like a mild bittersweet, not very nice to eat, and russeted. I have no idea what they are, but I really do need to get them identified, which I've been meaning to do for 10 years now, because it's been the backbone of our Clifton Beauty, which is one of our blends. So yeah, I think that's what we need to talk about with a name next time. I think,
yeah, variety. Definitely. But we were using a lot of the fruit, and we also worked with, what's that organisation that Jen was doing, the surplus fruit? Anyway, she was getting surplus fruit from the city, and then they were often had too much to know what to do with, and we would send a lot of the fruit to a refugee and asylum forum, or we'd send it to the food banks. We still do that. We still supply fruit and veg to the food bank and the refugee forum, but there's still so much fruit out there, and then the more you get known by the local community, the more you have phone calls saying, can you come and use this apple tree, you know, we don't do anything with it year by year.
Yeah.
And then that led on to, with Leo's connection, he does a lot of grafting and pruning around the city. We then got a couple of phone calls from people saying, oh, I've heard that could you come and do some pruning in my orchard? And a couple of stories of old orchards that have been there 20 years. That's going to make a noise. And not ever been pruned, basically. And so one lady phoned us, and her husband had planted an orchard and suddenly died literally the week later, and it'd never been touched, been there 15, 20 years.
Wow.
And so basically she asked if Leo would come and look at the orchard and prune it, and asked how much we would charge. And we said, well, what are you doing with the apples? She said, oh, they just go to the floor. So that was the first sort of main orchard that we got the opportunity to use. And then since then we've acquired another orchard, again similar story, couple have planted an orchard, it was too much for them, they needed help with pruning, and sort of that gave us the sort of backbone of having two sort of orchards. And we've since then the local farmer got wind of this, and he's then said, oh, well, I've planted an orchard, can you come help me with that? And so now we kind of do a lot of our pressing based on this farm. And, you know, it's a really nice relationship, because we sort of press juice for him and he lets us use his barn space for free, which is really, it's just a really great way of working together. So,
yeah, that sounds ideal.
So, yeah, I'm trying to think. Sorry, I'm a bit distracted because of B, but you do carry on.
Okay, so then the production of the cider, you've got all this local fruit that's coming in from orchards that you have to maintain, people bringing fruit to you. And then are you the one that's having to handpick all the fruit, or do you have volunteers, you have helpers?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's all handpicked. We don't import any apples or juice, and we do generally get a good response from the general community as well as the community garden. Just through, you know, social media, you get a few people who are interested, come picking and pressing for the day, and generally we pick in the morning and press in the afternoon. So it's all done you know, pretty quickly. And yeah, it seems to be a nice, happy place to be, because people enjoy doing it, and they can go home with a demijohn or a barrel of cider or just a few bottles, and yeah, everyone seems happy just pitching in. So
yeah, and then so you picked and pressed it, and then what happens after that point? Are you pitching yeast, are you wild?
Oh yeah, well, okay, so the cider itself, yeah, we use wild yeast, So I do the blending generally on the day because I've got to know the sort of apples we use. So we blend at the juicing stage, and then we ferment it quite often in our smoking barrels, is our whiskey barrel cider. So we use the whiskey barrels, which we were inspired by Broom Farm when I first came all those years ago. I came volunteered for the day, went home with a whiskey barrel, and after putting cider through one of those, I was hooked. So ever since then, each year, it's been creeping up, you know, five, and then I think we're on 10, do about 10 whiskey barrels a year. And yeah, we generally, apart from that, we use IBCs, and we use wild yeast, and then we sell it mainly wholesale to the pubs and bag and boxes, and more so in bottles recently, which we have several blends. We've got the Sherwood blend, which is a farmhouse style. We've got Clifton Beauty, which is, I think we mentioned those unknown ornamental trees, which has given it the backbone of the Clifton Beauty blend. And then we also have a Colic Perry, and that is generally single variety pears, which we've found, luckily, again, they were planted probably between 20 and 40 years ago around Nottingham ornamentally. So they are, in general, Pyrus communis of different forms. But we have managed to find a few thorn variety and brandy and butt, which we've also started growing ourselves, replanting old orchards. And so the perry is it's quite a sharp perry, it's quite astringent, and it's generally naturally sweet, because perry seems to stay sweet for longer, so we then process it and bottle it whilst it's still fairly sweet. And then our other side is a medium or medium dry. We do a small range of dry bottle conditioned or pet nat ciders as well, depending on when and if they occur. So yeah.
Great, okay.
And we're hoping to do more single varieties as the time goes on. What I forgot to mention as I went away, but we've planted our own orchards as well, so we've made more of a kind of mission to kind of choosing our own varieties. And we had the luck of being able to use a field that Leo's mum has in Cambridge that was used to have horses in, and she's retired, so now we've planted that up, and that was planted about 6 years ago, I think. So they're just about kind of starting to come into fruition a bit, but we've chosen our own varieties that we like in that, and we've got a variety of different ones from Dabernet and some Kingston Black.
We've got all the usual suspects really: Somerset Red Streak, Tremlett's Bitter, Chisel Jersey, Dabernet, a few Michelins, Black Dabernet, Homemaster's Jersey, and then a few more obscure ones. You know, just a selection of more heritage type apples, as well as a few dessert and a couple of eating culinary apples as well.
Mm-hmm. Not enough perry pears to my liking. Yeah. I need to get
not enough perry pears. Yeah, so what is the, I mean, you've obviously, you're making a broad range of cider and perry there. Do you mind, how much are you actually producing?
We're the standard 7,000 litre producers. Yeah. So although this year I don't know if it's going to be quite that much.
Yeah,
a bit thin on the ground.
And then, so is what you make, does it vary year to year based off what fruit's available, or does it tend to be relatively similar proportions?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it does vary. We only use probably about an average of 50% cider apples. I can never quite get enough cider apples. So at the moment, we've got it up to about 50% cider apples. Through many years of crawling through hedgerows and finding old abandoned orchards and, you know, regenerating old trees. So yeah, it does vary. I have to admit, our product does vary in acidity and tannins, which varies year to year quite dramatically. I know one patch of Blenheim orange trees, which one year it was like 7.4, the next year it was near a 6. So quite dramatic, and that's the acidity and the tannins, which vary as well, I've noticed, especially with perry. So yeah, it does vary, but actually I've found that no one really cares, so it's quite nice. I've never had a single complaint of anyone saying this year we blend is different to last year. They didn't seem to accept that, or maybe they've forgotten what it tasted like last year. Either way, we've winged it on that front. So yeah.
So okay, then in the microcosm, 2019 season, how did it go? Did you do anything new? Did anything stand out as being particularly good fruit? And how's it all turning out?
Yeah, it seemed to be probably an average year. The year before seemed to be very high sugar levels and seemed to be a vintage year. But last year, 2019, it was sort of average. Most of our ciders come out about 6.5. We had a massive amount of pears. So I've got twice the amount of pears I've ever had, which is good because there doesn't seem to be quite as many around where we are. So I've got a good old backlog of perry, which should keep us stocked for a while.
Which is good because that's popular, isn't it? The perry has proved to be really popular, and it's something that we've done well in as well in terms of the sort of camera award sort of thing. So
Well, it did very well at Manchester Brewing Cider Festival in January, didn't it?
Yeah, it went down really well there, which is nice to see. We got some good feedback, so yeah, it was good to hear that.
Yeah, so the perry's won a gold or a silver every year for the last 5 years in Nottinghamshire. So.
In East Midlands, yeah. Mm-hmm. But the thing that we tried, that we hadn't tried for the first time, because we're always trying to do at least one thing different, and I think I'm always like, we've always got to do something that we hadn't done the year before. So we were quite busy last year getting all our new labels and really wanted to make sure there was a bit more information on the labels about the sort of varieties and kind of like so that people get a bit more informed about cider varieties rather than, because it does kind of...
And the story.
Yeah, and the story. But it does kind of get me annoyed that people seem to know a lot about the wine varieties and the grapes, but if you ask them about cider varieties, they don't seem to know as much, which is just the way it is. But I think the tide's turning and people are getting to learn more about different apple varieties, which is great. So we really wanted to make sure that we had those listed on our labels so that people could kind of start recognising names of different apple varieties and the ones that they perhaps liked the taste of more. But the pet nap was the thing that we did, which was a new sort of technique that we hadn't done, we hadn't sold really. We tried it out at home, but we just hadn't really sort of bottled it and sold it. So that's new to our range that we did from 2019, isn't it?
Yeah, the pet nat and a bit more bottle conditioning as well, because I've always got about 10 or 20 Demijohns I still have in my garage testing different types of apple. And I think luckily if we get a cider, which has still got a bit of residual sugar and is not still too sharp, we can normally get it bottled there and then just at the right point. It's all about just catching at the right point. And then we seem to have come up with a few new brands which seem to be working out well, and people go down, it does go down quite well, because a bone dry cider, generally a lot of people are a bit scared of, but it does seem to be a bit of more of a market for it, maybe because it seems to be going down well. So
what is it, what you would choose to drink?
I'd probably say I like most ciders unless they're disgusting.
No, you don't like. I don't like ciders with sweeteners. Yeah. I've got a thing about sweeteners. Like, I don't know what it is. I think my tongue just doesn't. I get the aftertaste from sweeteners. We've literally on the tail end of a trip to Cornwall. So we're sort of 10 days into camping, and it's our last day. But we went and we found a few cideries in Cornwall, or tried some local cider from the shops. And some of them, they had the backbone of being the most lovely cider. There was obviously cider varieties in there, and it had really nice tannins, and the flavours coming through were lovely. They were dry. Well, you could tell they were dry to begin with, and then they'd just put in some sweetener, and it would be like, oh, just...
Yeah, there's another one. I won't mention any names, but there's a Cornish cider which had quite a clear mouse taint, really fancy bottles, and, you know, artificially carbonated, sweetened, and obviously commercially it's quite a big scale, but really not a very nice cider. And then there's another one which had a clear cherry off flavour, but I shouldn't write off Cornwall because we also found some absolute corkers.
Yeah,
I
think Crackington Haven was good.
Yeah, the Crackington cider, that was a nice little outfit, really nice couple who just did 7,000 litres and had a small range of still ciders which were just spot on. So
but in terms of what I like, I love dry cider and I love really tannic cider. I love single varieties as well. I love the fact that you can make such different ciders from just one fruit. I've had some really cracking Kingston Black single variety ciders and Davinettes and
I'd say the Tom Oliver Stoke Red was my favourite recently, I think. It was delicious. or any Perry by Ross Cider Company.
No, well, thank you. But yeah, so that means that this with this Pet Nat Dry, then, because you're more likely to be enthusiastic about it, that is going to bounce back off customers, and they're going to try it. So it's just something I think that, you know, a lot of cider makers, especially the ones that drink a lot of the cider, I mean, if you're a keet producer, then you're like keet, but we all like dry cider, but we're afraid of selling it.
Yeah.
And you make this lovely, great cider, and then you put sugar in it because you're worried it's not going to sell.
But yeah.
The more that we talk about what we're passionate about, dry cider, it rubs off. So you were saying with the Pet Nat, you find there's a sweet spot. How do you know that you're at the sweet spot? What are you looking for?
Yeah, well, it started off thinking about specific gravities and bottling it at a specific gravity between 1003, maybe 1007 or 8. Then I discovered some ciders would have literally no residual sugar on the hydrometer at all. But then if you bottled it, it'd still carbonate naturally. Then I realised, when I was talking to, saying how it's actually the malolactic fermentation, malolactic process, which is releasing the CO2, which is something you've got to look out for, really, because you can bottle a cider at 1007 or 8, and you can't guarantee the amount of fizz that's going to produce, because you've got this malolactic thing happening as well, producing CO2. So it's a bit of a tricky field to fathom. And yeah, as I say, I've had a really nice, lightly sparkling cider with literally zero residual sugar. So yeah, it's a trick one to tackle, but I think as long as you keep on trying your product and maybe not leave it around for too many years, then yeah, it works out all right.
Mm-hmm. And with your Pet Nat, how many times are you racking it? Is it the same as normal, and you just...
Yeah, no, you're right, actually. Good point. It's the more we've racked it, the generally you can keep the residual sugars in there, because obviously you're taking away the yeast sediment, and it drops bright. And so as soon as it's normally the really clear ciders which have the residual ciders on. So if it drops bright pretty quickly, rack it off. Mm. And if there's any sediment at the bottom, rack it off again. And generally we find that we ended up with something which is still a bit of residual sugar in naturally. And because we generally use quite a lot of sharp apples, it's tricky, because normally we have to leave our ciders quite a long time, compared to if you have the luxury of loads of bittersweets, where you can get it all processed, bottled up, packaged away